Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks, The Learning College. Today we're going to dig further into the feminization of American culture by Anne Douglas, feminist in the 70s. Book was published by Avon Books, copyright 1977. The purpose of this is to understand how it came to be that women are deferred to across the board in the West. And secondarily, the rise of consumerism and all these other things that served the Jews. This book is not overtly about Jews, but it is about how women and weak men sort of set the stage for the unmanning of America, the softening, the consumerizing of America, leading into the 20th century, where the reins of that altered mentality could be picked up by the Jews and whip the horse along their road. So today we'll do chapter 6, The Domestication of Death. It's, I don't know, 20, 30 pages maybe, from 240 to 272, so 32 pages. Again, The Feminization of American Culture by Anne Douglas. I'm Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. The Domestication of Death, chapter 6, The Posthumous Congregation, The Fascination with Death and Mourning. To say that the memoirs of women and clergymen were concerned with death is an understatement. To a degree that requires special consideration, they were exercises in necrophilia. They revealed as much of the art of the mortician or the gravestone cutter as of the craft of the biographer. Contemporaries on occasion described the memorialist's efforts in strikingly literal funereal terms. The Unitarian George Ellis, reviewing Sprague's Annals of the American Pulpit in 1857, called Sprague a, quote, sepulchral artist, carving the gravestone of his ministerial predecessors. Ellis was particularly moved by the fact that at least 80 of the ministers who contributed biographical information to Sprague's first two volumes had died by the time of publication. Six of these contributors were between the ages of 90 and 100. Ellis described the letters various clergymen wrote in tribute to deceased colleagues as the dewy flowers and the green grass growing over graves where tears have been freshly shed. Nothing shows more clearly the underlying motive of the memoirs than the fact that a moving death, rather than a stirring life, provided the suitable qualification for treatment. Children, veritable infants, became a conventional subject not just of poetry, but of full-scale biology, or biography. Tots like Agnes Adams and Little Georgie Cuyler, the respective protagonist, if one may use the word in this connection, of Agnes in the Key of Her Little Coffin, 1857, and The Empty Crib, 1873, were notable, understandably, less for their lives, which were usually short, than for their deaths, which were often protracted. Even in the memoirs devoted to adults, life gains its interest chiefly as a prelude to death. The reader is reminded from the outset that the memorialized is going to die, perhaps young, certainly well. A host of examples comes to mind, but none is more striking than the biography of the Reverend William Peabody, written shortly after his death in 1847 by his brother Oliver, William Peabody. Peabody was a fervent Christian, an opponent of controversial divinity, a defender of the Sabbath, and a pioneer in the cemetery and Sunday school movements, a literary man of real, if minor, talent, who contributed to the Christian Examiner, the North American Review, and The Token. He published rather gentle pieces on autumn and death. His best poem began with a characteristic euphemistic melancholy. Behold the western evening light. It melts in deepening gloom. So calmly Christians sink away, descending to the tomb. From the start, Oliver Peabody depicts William as one too good to live, the kind of pale, serious, sickly, pious little child that wise old women were always clucking prophetically over in the domestic novels of the day we've heard about in earlier sessions. William survived childhood, however, to marry an extremely devout woman whose resolve to give, quote, all the power of her soul to a private intercourse with God had an immense impact on her husband. When she died at an early age in 1843, he told himself that she had been called first so that he might learn through sorrow to be more worthy of her. Cherishing his grief, he liked to sit by moonlight near her grave. His links with this life were further attenuated when his eldest daughter died suddenly at only 4 months after his wife. At this point in the Peabody biography, an extraordinary thing happens. A new and anonymous writer explains, quote, "The pen fell from the hands of Oliver Peabody just as he approached his brother's moving deathbed scene." As William might have said, Oliver had, quote, "calmly sunk away." The consumptive Oliver had originally been a lawyer. He found himself unsuited, however, to enforced contact with a quarreling and litigious world, and turned to the ministry in middle life. The step from the ministry to the grave was apparently the only logical one at this point in his spiritual history. Oliver felt that, in writing his brother's story, quote, "he was carving the letters on his own gravestone." Oliver's successor, the second biographer, luckily survives his task, describes William's saintly and gentle death, and includes a memoir of Oliver for good measure. A memoir like this is not only a biography, it is part of what can be called contemporary consolation literature. This enormously popular genre included obituary poems and memoirs, mourner's manuals, prayer guidebooks, hymns, and books about heaven. This is how people, in large measure, entertained themselves before television. Such writings inflated the importance of dying and the dead by every possible means. They sponsored elaborate methods of burial and commemoration, communication with the next world, and microscopic viewings of a sentimentalized afterlife. Their authorship was typically, although not exclusively, clerical or feminine. Notice the two become the same, and the Jews can use this. Oh, we feminized the church. The masculine men are off in business. They're making money, so they don't directly threaten us. But we can use the women, the home front, the kids, turn them all in our direction. And this is a subset of that. This mawkishness, I would call it, or lugubriousness. You know, two of my favorite words. The causes for the widespread success of consolatory literature were many and complex. At this point, what is clear about readers' demands is largely negative. Consolation literature probably does not reflect an actual increase in the death rate of children or adults, although it may point to changing expectations about mortality. More can perhaps be ventured about the author's motivation. Says Anne Douglas, "I have already said that women and ministers, in an effort to rationalize and glamorize their position, were engaged in subordinating historical progress to biological process. Engaged in subordinating historical progress to biological process. Barred by external taboos and internal anxieties from elaboration on the overtly sexual acts of impregnation and childbirth, they concentrated on illness and death. They were more interested in the moments at which crude energy failed than in those at which it accelerated. The glorification of death offered the final crucial strategy in the effort to anthropologize historical inquiry. As Mrs. Sigourney's patriarch suggests, forgotten lives are remembered by Mother Earth. The tombstone is the sacred emblem in the cult of the overlooked. It is hardly accidental that the ornate statuary, which increasingly decorated Victorian graves, has some resemblance to enlarged victory trophies. Symbolized and congratulated by stone angels, the dead were not losers, but winners. Mid-19th century cemeteries were the paradoxical progenitors of a later generation's halls of fame." So the Victorian Hall of Fame is the cemetery. "The clerical feminine commitment to stress and exaggerate the value of those apparently wasted and insignificant, quote, ordinary lives, which patriotic history and industrial development too often neglected, reached its logical culmination in an imaginative reinterpretation of the doctrine of the resurrection of the dead." They're resurrected in literature and prayer books and hymnals and all this stuff. It's where these people are overlooked in the building of America, and the politics and the business given over to the active men are what draws the headlines. But Here the women and the weaker clerical types are pushing their own ordinary lives through the cemetery and writing about illness and death, is what she's saying. If the insignificant could be proved to be the significant, if the dead could live, today they would say marginalized voices on the margin are being restored and giving women a voice. That type of thing is how they would do it. If the dead could live, ministers and women could establish a new balance of power in the free-for-all, intensely competitive democracy of American culture. Like politicians engineering egalitarian triumphs by stumping fresh territory, drumming up new votes, and even inventing voters, they multiplied the numbers and enhanced the resources of their supporters. Some might see the election as rigged, but the victory was theirs. And they were hardly the last participants in the drama of popular American culture, partially to invent the public they captured. Lydia H. Sigourney, in one of the more striking among her almost countless obituary poems, "'Twas But a Babe," rhetorically upbraided an unspecified urban male passerby, apparently absorbed in his commercial profit-mongering and indifferent to a sad funeral procession wending its way behind a little coffin to the local graveyard. Quote, "Poise ye in the rigid scales of calculation, the fond bosom's wealth," she inquired bitterly. Sigourney's implicit point is that the private rituals of mourning should outweigh the public demands of business, that the claims of home and church should count for more than the imperatives of the marketplace. Her initial tone of indignation suggests her awareness that, in plain fact, most competitive middle-class American men did not share her priorities. When Mrs. Sigourney turns, however, to detailing the imagined grief of the bereaved parents, she notes with particular approval and sympathy the, quote, "mute father with his grief-worn and pallid brow." By the poem's close, revitalized by imaginary contact with such domestic scenes and sentiments, Mrs. Sigourney is preaching with full ministerial confidence to a more general audience, all, quote, who mourn a, quote, vacant cradle. The pattern of Miss Sigourney's little poem is characteristic of most of the consolation literature of the period, an explicitly or implicitly hostile protest against the competitive, aggressive, non-familial society. A chastened reminder that everyone will be forced, sooner or later, by the death of a loved one or by his or her own death, to turn from public to private considerations, and a tactful hint as to where the needed comfort at such hours can be found. Mrs. Sigourney anticipates the modern undertaker. Her poem is a way of leaving her card. Quote, "If you should need my services, and you will." The world of consolation literature is a domestic and a personal one, a place where the minister and the mother become at last the only genuine authorities. Elizabeth Prentice, who wrote the best-selling Stepping Heavenward in 1869, a classic of 19th-century consolation literature, once gave an interesting and revealing definition of the function of a pastor's wife, a position she herself occupied. There was an obligation, or rather an opportunity, quote, "to feel the right to sympathize with those who mourn, to fly to them at once, and join them in their prayers and tears." She continued, quote, "It would be pleasant to spend one's whole time among sufferers, and to keep testifying to them what Christ can and will become to them, if they will only let him." I mean, that's the sick mentality of the Jesus called in the imaginary afterworld, and people basing their whole lives around this, whether it's the husband preaching or the wife tending to the people he's preaching to. She continued, well, "it would be pleasant to spend one's whole time among the sufferers and to keep testifying to them what Christ can and will become to them if they will only let him." Direct quote. Clearly, such moments gave unusual power not only to Christ's word, but to those who conveyed it, the minister himself or his wife. His literary efforts were often veiled reminders of the last hour and of his own crucial role in it. We have seen that Hopkins was never more the teacher than at the bedsides of dying parishioners. The liberal pastor, in contrast, was the comforter, winning entrance which at other times was denied to him. Intercessor between God and man, heaven and earth, he was the supplicant, the pleader at the throne, as Carolyn Sawyer described Ballou. His power came from the fact that, at such a moment, supplication is the only possible mode of expression. The clergyman's chance, like the woman's, was now coincidental with the weakest moment of his parishioners. No longer confident that he could meet his congregation at their strongest or impress its ablest representatives, the men of intellect and talent, in their stores, counting houses, and courtrooms, the minister increasingly fell back upon an inner parish of women and those men who had been reduced to playing the woman's role. His congregation consisted of those who were feeling rather than thinking. And that is something that can be turned to great political use by anyone when a population has been essentially dumbed down and trained to value the feminine thinking more than the masculine, the feminine feeling more than the masculine thinking. So a lot of dangers in what might seem merely women's stuff or emo stuff, attending, you know, the necessary rituals of life after death, but there's a greater meaning to it, a greater use to it. The sensitized mourner was clearly of vital and new significance in this domestic drama. The authors of mourning manuals directed their books toward the actually and recently bereaved parent, husband, or wife seeking reassurance. Private, particular grief, in other words, was their declared starting point and raison d'etre. Of course, the ordeal of the Christian survivor, forced to realize that he had idolized a loved one taken from him by a chastening God, was traditional in New England religious writing. The 17th and 18th centuries, however, had no real cult of mourning literature. The griever was seen as culpable, if human. His condition was hardly considered one of particular fascination in the same way, for example, that the state of a sinner on the eve of a conviction might be. Thomas Shepard, a prominent 17th century divine, devoted only an eloquent page and a half to the loss of his adored wife, and he concluded his account with a characteristic stroke of partial self-condemnation. Quote, "Thus God hath visited and scourged me for my sins, and sought to wean me from this world, but I have ever found it a difficult thing to profit even but a little by the sorest and sharpest afflictions." Anne Bradstreet, writing in 1665 on the death of a grandchild, explained the irrelevance of what later generations would call mourning. Quote, "Blessed babe, why should I once bewail thy fate, or sigh thy days so soon were terminate, sith thou art settled in an everlasting state?" In sharp contrast, the bereaved 19th century authors of tributes like The Empty Crib, The Memorial of Little Georgie, and Agnes in the Key of Her Little Coffin, quite frankly assumed, and apparently got, the engrossed attention of significant portions of their society for their emotional and moral state. Reverend Theodore Cuyler, C-U-Y-L-E-R, the prominent New York clergyman who wrote The Empty Crib, received thousands of more than sympathetic letters from kindred mourners. Cuyler appended some of these epistles in The Empty Crib. I will quote from one to give the flavor of all. So the guy writes a book, The Empty Crib, The Memorial of Little Georgie. He gets thousands of letters from people, and he puts some of them in a subsequent edition's appendage. And she quotes from one and says, this is the flavor of all of them. "My dear sir, if it ever falls in your way to visit Allegheny Cemetery, you will see there a flower on three little graves. Anna, aged 7 years, Sadie, aged 5 years, Lily, aged 3 years, all died within 6 days, and all of scarlet fever." Cuyler's Georgie died of scarlet fever also. "It sometimes may reconcile us to our own affliction to hear of one still greater elsewhere, and this is the reason why I, a perfect stranger, venture to trespass upon you in your sore bereavement and to tell you of my heartfelt sympathy." So they're one-upping each other on their the deaths of their puny tots. There is no escaping the sense that grief is not being used here as discipline in the way Shepherd and Bradstreet used it in the earlier centuries, but as therapeutic self-indulgence. And you can see how this would translate into the age of the selfie. It's just a different form that it took. There was no electronics back then, so everything was literary, but it was still the same show-offiness, the same attention-whoring, even over the death of your own kids. Mourning is still intended clearly to foster spiritual development, but a curious exhibitionism seems to be doing the work formerly expected of self-scrutiny. bragging about your losses. The bereaved shall be the gainers, if not of the world's goods and positions, at least of its concern. Even if the mourner figure is neither a minister nor a mother, he is a possible stand-in for them. Grieving entails an experience of powerlessness which unites them all. The attention the mourner is so lavishly granted by his authors compensates him for more losses, perhaps, than he has consciously suffered. In these annals of grief, the deceased, like the mourner, shows striking if unacknowledged affinities with the author. The dying or dead child is the most conspicuous exemplar of the new turn to the old prophecy, "The last shall be first." So, upending the social status or inverting the social pyramid structure. From busy men to passive mourning women and weak clergy. Agnes and Georgie were supposedly guides to their adult supervisors in ways that must have been most suggestive and flattering to their maternal and ministerial biographers, many of whom knew well what it was like to be treated, even to function, as children in a world of unheeding adults, that is, the men. Furthermore, these small household saints, according to their biographers, usually chose their mother or their minister as their model. Little James, an early deceased son of the Universalist minister Sylvester Cobb, was memorialized by his mother, Eunice Hale Cobb, in 1852. According to her account, he was a clergyman in embryo. As a very young child, he disliked, quote, to mingle with the boys at school so as to hear their profane and vulgar language. He advised, quote, respect to the aged, and once rebuked a man who referred to his father as the old gentleman. He loved the Bible, took communion at age 7, and was wont to argue with fellow passengers on boats and trains against the use of tobacco. As he was a larval scold. If he emulated his ministerial father, he adored his mother. During his last sickness, he expressed his wish to her that, quote, we could die with our arms around each other's neck. The dying infant was made supremely to flatter his feminine and clerical biographers. He shared their weakness while he dignified and extended their authority. The process of extension often took on nearly supernatural characteristics. The special quality of a biography like Oliver Peabody's memoir of his brother lies in the rather sepulchral sense it gives the readers that they are listening to a posthumous voice. During William Peabody's last months, he seemed, to his loving congregation, to be increasingly, quote, standing on the confines of the eternal world, as one ready to be offered, permitted just before entering its gate, to point out to those he loved, with the failing accents of a dying voice, the way to reach its blessedness. Mrs. Sigourney played daringly on the enticing boundaries between life and death where the Peabody brothers apparently lingered. In her poetry, she was apt, as an everyday matter, to overlook the apparently trivial distinction between the living and the dead female. She pictures one deceased maiden lying, quote, in calm endurance, like the smitten lamb, wounded in flowery pastures. Is the girl dead or merely stricken? Even Mrs. Sigourney's narrative posture betrays the same fascinated confusion. Her only attempt at a novel, Lucy Howard's Journal, the sad story of a Christian housewife's progress in piety and family life, purports to be the diary of a dead woman presented to the world by her rather guiltily surviving spouse. Lucy Howard speaks from beyond the grave. As luck would have it, Mrs. Sigourney's own autobiography, Letters of Life, which she began in the early 1860s, was almost complete when she died in 1865. The book, finished by other hands, has some of the same otherworld posthumous authority which she granted Lucy Howard's infinitely less interesting account. Mrs. Sigourney's last recorded words were the benignly all-inclusive ones, I love everybody. A few decades before, Mrs. Sigourney had published a sentimentalized biographical sketch entitled Margaret and Henrietta, 1835. According to her account, Margaret had died with the same phrase on her lips. Could Mrs. Sigourney have mentally noted the appeal of such a line and stored it up, and finally reenacted a deathbed scene which she had in part invented? Long before she uttered her last words, Mrs. Sigourney was prone to usurp the authority of the dead. Prior to her marriage in her late 20s, she had been a distinguished schoolteacher in Hartford. In later years, she liked to keep up with her former pupils through annual spring picnic processions in the woods near Hartford. These rituals were clearly extraordinarily important to Mrs. Sigourney's psyche. She maintained them for decades, graciously including pupils' children as well as pupils. She wrote a regular account of them, perhaps the only thing she penned that she never published, entitled A Record of My School. The attraction of the reunions for their organizer seems obvious. Here, she could play out the funereal fantasy she had developed in her poetry, her novel, and finally in her memoir. The girls, later to be middle-aged women, marched to the Sylvan spot, ceremoniously dressed in white. Sylvan means woodsy. Pennsylvania. Penn's woods. The girls marched to the Sylvan spot, ceremoniously dressed in white, flanked by processions of handicapped children from Hartford's Deaf and Dumb Asylum, a special interest of Miss Sigourney's. Once arrived at the glade, quote-unquote, that's an opening in a forest, they presumably ate in picnic fashion, though Mrs. Sigourney characteristically downplays such healthy and gross activity, and listened to their former preceptor's yearly talk. Mrs. Sigourney's focus was always the same. She dwelt lovingly on whomever of the original group had passed away during the preceding year. The death at a young age from consumption or childbirth complications was frequent among Mrs. Sigourney's pupils, can hardly be denied by anyone who looks over the statistics which she, a sentimental Madame Lafarge, accumulated in her record. That Mrs. Sigourney was doing more than recording obvious and tragic facts is equally clear to anyone reading through the actual obituary sermon she delivered on the lost, quote, floweret of the year. Flower with E.T. on the end. Even more striking, however, is Mrs. Sigourney's penchant for talking as one who has herself barely escaped the perils of death. At the first reunion in 1822, presumably in her usual plump and ruddy good health, she nonetheless urges her listeners to go on meeting annually, even if, quote, the voice that now addresses you shall be silent, the lip that has uttered prayers for your welfare should be sealed in the dust of death. So very mawkish. But really, not actually mawkish, because getting off on it. Genuine mawkish would have an element of unhappiness, but hers is basically, it's all for show. You can feel the woman delivering this stuff. In 1823, she tells her hearers that since they last met, she has been sick, has been, at least in thought, on the confines of the abode of the spirits, and has brought back solemn words of wisdom. Mrs. Sigourney has assumed a clerical role. More important, she has become her own medium. The Fox sisters did not begin their table rappings in upstate New York until 1848. Remember, mesmerism and seances and all this stuff. The burned over district where a lot of crazy ideas or isms that Southern intellectuals would denounce came out of this region of New York, essentially the western part, by Syracuse or the Finger Lakes around there. Mormonism came out of there. So the Fox sisters did not begin their table rappings in upstate New York until 1848. Remember, also, that date's associated with the Seneca Women's Convention, one of the first bits of proto-feminism in the U.S. and the world. But Mrs. Sigourney had in several senses anticipated them. She was straining for the authority conferred on the Peabodys, the power granted by the privilege of extraterrestrial communication. So if they believe in Christianity, they believe in an afterlife, heaven, hell, and purgatory. There's obviously would be some inherent power or something that could certainly be commercialized even, if you can communicate with those in this next and supposedly better world. Several of the little saints whose early deaths drew so many sympathetic tears showed extrasensory abilities similar to Mrs. Sigourney's. It was not just a matter of the conventional little finger pointing upward, the smile on the once rosy lips, the last gasp, Mother, or Jesus. A dying child like James Cobb enjoyed extended communications with the spirit world. He watched angels dancing in anticipation of his speedy arrival and saw various deceased members of his own family and relayed their immediate messages back to the living. He was quite literally a medium. And after his death, he continued to appear to his relatives. Death, province of minister and mother, instead of marking the end of power, had become its source. Spiritualism, in its most generalized and most specific senses, was a manifestation of a complex retransfer of force from the living to the dead, and from the apparently strong to the apparently weak. Books on spiritualism and the afterlife, like Elizabeth Ellet's Watching Spirits, 1851, and Mrs. H. D. Williams's Voices from the Silent Land, 1853, Daniel Eddy's Angel Whispers, 1855, and William Holcomb's Our Children in Heaven, 1868, conveyed the clear impression that death widened, rather than limited, the ministerial and maternal sphere of influence. These sainted dead hovering around their old haunts, whether women, ministers, or pious children, eternally firm in the virtues inculcated by their mothers and their pastors, were so many witnesses, even spies, for the church and the home. At work here is the compensation process I spoke of earlier. If you cannot make converts among the living, declare them among the dead. Death must become, not exactly life, but a controlled extension of the feelings and property rights of the living. That ends that subsection. The Posthumous Congregation, the Fascination with Death and Mourning. Next up, the Rural Cemetery Movement. Before the early 19th century, Americans buried their deceased in the local churchyard. The relative absence of ostentation in these simple graves, the abandonment of the distinctions of wealth or birth, which had presumably interested those buried there when alive, suggested forcibly that the dead were no longer concerned with this world. But by the 1830s, a new and very different method of treating the dead, what would prove to be the modern method, began to find acceptance. The intramural churchyard was replaced by the landscaped, quote, garden, or, quote, rural cemetery, located away from the church on the outskirts of a town or village. Developing awareness of the laws of hygiene in part motivated the shift from the old crowded churchyard to the spacious lawn cemetery. This awareness in no way accounts, however, for the new conspicuous elaboration which characterized the layout and development of the new cemeteries. It is hardly surprising that the same groups who produced the consolation literature of the period promoted and extolled the rural cemetery and the innovative modes of burial which accompanied it. So more elaborate cemeteries are relocated from churchyards in the middle of the city to the outside of the city, and from just being sort of egalitarian in the gravestones, they're going to be their elaborate, larger plots and monuments. And this was what this started happening really in the 1830s, and this is kind of more the modern way. And functional hygiene had something to do with it, she's saying. The rural cemetery movement officially began in America in 1831 with the opening of Mount Auburn, the first garden cemetery in the Western world, except for Paris's Père Lachaise, where Oscar Wilde and Jim Morrison and others are buried. Père Lachaise. New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, and Salem were among the many American cities quickly to follow Cambridge's lead. The pioneering Boston enterprise was distinctly Unitarian, Brahmin, sentimental, and literary. Among the founding fathers were the Unitarian lawyer and writer Joseph Story, the antiquarian author and temperance reformer Lucius Sargent, the Unitarian clergyman and poet John Pierpont, and the ex-Unitarian clergyman and prominent orator Edward Everett. At the consecration of the cemetery in 1831, Henry Ware Sr. led the prayer and Judge Story gave the address. The new, planned, and picturesque rural cemeteries, unlike their intramural predecessors, were dedicated to the idea that the living and the dead still cared. Paths with pastoral names, gentle rills, green slopes, and newly popular graveside flowers flattered the presumed docility of the deceased. The severe tombstones of 17th century New England, with their stark reminders of the fact of death, a cross, a death's head, or an hourglass, had given way in the late 18th century to new anthropomorphic designs. Actual, if crude, portraits of the deceased appeared. Allegorical pictures of the resurrection, tastefully adorned with willow trees, were in evidence by 1800. So it's in line with the general softening, the death memorials. By the 1840s, statues of what one popular graveyard guidebook calls weeping female figures marked various family plots in Mount Auburn. Mrs. Sigourney had been immortalized and mass-produced in Marvel. Lachrymose verse, a la Sigourney, decorated ornate gravestones. Quote, "In Jesus' arms we laid her down, a lovely jewel for his crown," were typical lines inscribed on the gravestone of a young girl in Princeton, New Jersey. Quote, "Asleep in Jesus" was a popular caption for children's tombs everywhere. Reverend Kyler, passing an afternoon at New York's Greenwood Cemetery near the grave of his little Georgie, bid his son a by no means final adieu. Quote, "The air was silent as the unnumbered sleepers around me, and turning toward the sacred spot where my precious dead was lying, I bade him, as of old, good night." Greenwood was to Kyler, quote, "simply a vast and exquisitely beautiful dormitory. It is not so much that the dead are alive as that they are altogether accessible to the living." Developing funeral customs carefully fostered the same illusions the cemetery created. The dead person was reincarnated as a kind of hideous euphemism for a living one. It seems no accident that corpses were increasingly made to resemble dolls. There was a growing de-emphasis on somber mourning clothes and gloomy funerary practices. Sylvester Judd left directions for his own apparent laying out. He was arranged for viewing in apparent comfort upon his couch, as if in a quiet, natural slumber. A winter rose lay by his side. According to his biographer, quote, "gloominess and dread were banished." The deceased were to compliment and imitate their survivors rather than threaten them. Elaborate and highly differentiated metal caskets replaced wooden ones in the early 19th century, although many protested their use. The metal casket, unlike its predecessor, ensured that neither it nor its contents would disintegrate or return to the earth for a long time. The actual designs of the new coffins were clearly intended to please the taste of the living. Nehemiah Adams began his account of Agnes and the key of her little coffin by explaining that there had been a great improvement in the design of children's coffins. They no longer had broken lines and angles. They looked like other things, and not like that which looks like nothing else, a coffin. He added, rather maladroitly, "You would be willing to have such a shape for the depositing of any household article." There was apparently a soft lining and a nameplate inside the box, and a lock and key had replaced the old remorseless screws and screwdrivers. While 18th-century American families generally prepared their deceased for burial at home in simple and straightforward ways, outside organizers began to proliferate in the early 19th century, first the midwife or the livery stable keeper or the sexton, and finally the professional undertaker, the increasing specialization. In the old days, everything goes from generalization to specialization. So first it was handled by the family, then by people who were in other trades, and then by there was a specific trade devoted to it, the professional undertaker. The undertaker's art took a gigantic stride forward with the practice of embalming, initiated during the Civil War, though not widespread until the 20th century. Embalming. The new funeral directors of the later 19th century, with their double emphasis on business and sentimentality, were the heirs of the liberal ministers and lady authors who had helped create the sensibility of mid-century. By the 1880s, there was a National Funeral Directors Association with a representative organ called Sunnyside. It competed successfully with a rival periodical entitled Shadyside, which could issue touching and ludicrous statements to the press like the following, quote, "Funeral directors are members of an exalted, almost sacred calling. The executive committee believed that a cut in prices would be suicidal. A $1,000 prize was offered for the best appearing corpse after 60 days. A resolution was passed requesting the newspapers in reporting the proceedings to refrain from flippancy." That'd be nearly impossible, wouldn't it? Of course, the, quote, "best-appearing corpse" was the most lifelike one. Nothing speaks more clearly to the transformation of death the rural cemeteries promulgated, than their promotion as places of resort, well-suited to holiday excursions. They functioned as a Disney World for the mortuary imagination of Victorian America. Sylvester Judd, in his late days as a student at Harvard Divinity School in the late 1830s, was fond of a stroll among the tombstones. For him, Mount Auburn was, quote, that place of beauty and death, of melancholy and delight. In 1859, one young man from Connecticut made a special pilgrimage to the spot. His reactions ranged from a borrowed aesthetic piety to indigenous class consciousness. Quote, what a vast lot of money I saw piled up in the monuments. Oh, what pleasure there is in walking among the dead. So say the people. By 1876, James Cabot Lowell could write rather unkindly about his fellow Bostonians that their idea of a proper hospitality automatically included a dinner with uncongenial and ill-sorted people and, quote, a drive in Mount Auburn Cemetery where you will see the worst man can do in the way of disfiguring nature. Hamlet went to the graveyard in a mood of alienation from his kind, of philosophical despair. He resorted to the churchyard to confront some ultimate reality. The mid-19th century American went to the cemetery rather in the spirit in which his 20th century descendant goes to the movies, with the hopefulness attended upon the prospect of borrowed emotions. Interesting, that's a good analogy. The rural cemetery's camouflage of death was so entire that its purpose came paradoxically to seem the creation of the illusion of death for the vicarious edification and stimulation of the living. So it's like an emotional park, a place you can feel emotions, borrowed emotions, like a movie, rather than a place for the dead, for the emotions the dead can raise in the living. The cemetery functioned not like experience, but like literature. It was in several senses a sentimental reader's paradise. The Sunday stroller could peruse the saccharine inscriptions, which I have already mentioned. Moreover, hundreds of official and unofficial literary guides to the various graveyards appeared during the middle decades of the century. The picturesque pocket companion and visitor's guide through Mount Auburn was out by the late 1830s, when the cemetery was less than a decade old. It included Judge Story's address in toto and a detailed description of the most interesting among the monuments, and closed with Miscellanies, a collection of prose and poem pieces on death and graveyards. There were pieces by the sentimental literateur Willis G. Clark, the famous English poet Mrs. Hemans, and the gifted young Nathaniel Hawthorne. In 1844, Carolyn F. Orne, a very minor talent, helpfully published a book of poems entitled Sweet Auburn and Mount Auburn with Other Poems. Of the six stories Mrs. Sigourney included in The Young Lady's Offering in 1847, five closed with graveyard scenes and funeral processions. The visitor to Mount Auburn and other cemeteries was clearly intended to stop under an inviting willow or pause near an artificial pond and read aloud. The funerary literature in the rural cemeteries themselves did not present death merely as provocation for the sensibility of the living, however, they advertised it in curious ways as matter for actual appropriation and acquisition. The funerary literature in the rural cemeteries themselves did not present death merely as provocation for the sensibility of the living, however, they advertised it in curious ways as matter for actual appropriation and acquisition. The topography of the cemeteries, like the language used to describe them, suggested a utopian preservation, literalization, and even objectification of a conservatively conceived past. They were the emblem and the site for the biologically oriented, cyclical history promoted by women and ministers, which I discussed in the last chapter. One commentator explained that graveyards provide the common man with his only lesson in biography. According to a critic for the New Englander in 1831, the rural cemetery demonstrated to observers that, quote, in the mighty system of the universe, not a single step of the destroyer, time, but is made subservient to some ulterior purpose of reproduction, and the circle of creation is eternal. The originators and supporters of the rural cemeteries had intended them to serve as negotiable sanctuaries from the present. An advocate analyzed their appeal. The retirement they afford to surviving friends and their visits to the graves of loved ones, the quiet precincts of the sacred place, made beautiful by the embellishments of artistic tillage and the inspiration of natural scenery, combine to make attractive and sacred the city of the dead. They become places of respectful and reverent resort. In accordance with their name and in contrast to the intramural churchyards they replaced, the rural cemeteries were located out of town. Away from the urban bustle and noise, they were to be uncrowded, pre-industrial, privatized. The quiet atmosphere of the cemeteries was strictly enforced. Those responsible for the development of Mount Auburn in 1831, for example, laid down careful regulations about the planning and use of its grounds. The trustees of the spot had the right to remove, quote, offensive and improper monuments. No vehicles were allowed but those owned by proprietors, owners of plots. No one was allowed within the gates on Sundays and holidays except proprietors. As such restrictions suggest, the sentimental impulse ostensibly responsible for the creation and policing of the rural cemeteries was in part a disguise for an impulse of ownership like the one motivating the new ministerial and feminine history. Nostalgia, here and elsewhere, functioned as a spiritualized form of acquisition. Until the 1880s, proprietors disfigured their plots by the erection of iron railings. Cemeteries bristling with such jealous markers gave evidence of squatters' rights rather than of mourners' grief. Francis and Teresa Pubsky, a foreign couple visiting America in 1853, objected to the custom in frank language. Quote, exclusiveness little befits a cemetery. The idea of private property carried even into the realm of the dead has something unnaturally strange. Observers were particularly fond of describing the rural cemeteries in terms which likened them to that emblem of the possibilities of ownership, the middle-class home. One commentator on the law of burial and the sentiment of death for the Christian Examiner in 1836 expressed his belief that the graveyards could foster, quote, the sentiment of retrospection and reverence, and draw their visitors from the busy competition and hurried ambitious spirit of the day. This, of course, was also the language used in the period to describe the ideal American home, also by definition pre-industrial. In the words of a popular domestic manual by a Reverend Phillips, the home was the heart's moral oasis, like the cemetery. It was a refuge for the bereaved and disappointed. Another writer for the Christian Examiner made the comparison explicit. Thoughts provoked by the cemetery, quote, give a new aspect to all our social relations and confer upon our homes, particularly, where these relations are the most intimate, a peculiar sacredness. So you look at the cemetery and it leads you to reflect on the transience of human wishes and desires. Even our nearest and closest will be taken from us. Yea, even we ourselves must one day go under this and see the other side of the soil. We'll do another two pages and stop there as we get halfway through this chapter. I'll try to keep these about an hour. It was no accident that the same architectural thinking underlay the new proto-suburban domestic architecture and the new rural graveyards. The idea of the picturesque, as formulated by Andrew Jackson Downing, dominated both. A landscape gardener and an architect, Downing was also a man of letters and a close friend of polite literary men like George Custis and Nathaniel Willis, or George Curtis and Nathaniel Willis. He edited a magazine entitled Horticulture and wrote several books. Socially conservative, of the genteel school in every sphere, he attempted to civilize, moderate, and control the taste and homes of America's business-minded middle class. As one contemporary put it, Downing wished, quote, to infuse a spirit and a grace in forms otherwise admirable only for their usefulness. Downing's architectural theories rested on what he called the theory of association. In the cultivated country life, which his proto-suburban styles were meant to emulate or approximate, in his words, quote, Everything lends its aid to awaken the finer sensibilities of our nature. The heart has there, always within reach, something on which to bestow its affections. We begat a partiality for every copse that we have planted. Downing's style was meant, as his friend Nathaniel Willis perceived, to foster, quote, a most careful culture of home associations, to strengthen memory, not ambition. This theory of association is the familiar doctrine of influence, which we have already seen used to rationalize and recoup feminine and ministerial powers. Architecture, whether in cemetery landscaping or suburban homes, became one of the ways in which the less aggressive purported to correct the sensibility of their competitive society. So you're either aggressive or you're passive-aggressive, so everybody's aggressive in his own way. As a gentleman should, Downing took his artistic principles from England. But in doing so, he avoided the grandiose as inappropriate to a democratic country. He classified domestic homes and grounds under two headings: the beautiful, characterized by a gentle and flowing style, and the picturesque, dominated by a more abrupt and irregular one. The picturesque, generally preferred by Americans, was in actuality a debased version of what German writers and scholars at the turn of the century had called the, quote, sublime. Remember, this would be the period of German Romanticism, the 1800, 1830. By this term, sublime, they designated the wild and almost anarchic elements of the natural and mortal landscape perceived and assimilated by the human mind only at great peril to itself. The excitement and challenge of the sublime was precisely what Downing chose to ignore. Unlike the productions of the sublime, the picturesque landscape or building is not an illustration of the laws of motion. The difference is that between a torrent and a rill, a rushing waterfall and a babbling brook. Change in the picturesque world is merely decorative. One of Downing's supporters and helpers explained that he wished to counteract the, quote, restlessness and disposition to change which is characteristic of our people, you know, filling a growing continent. The picturesque cottage-style home was to be modest but delightful. The surrounding land was groomed by judicious planting into a carefully controlled mimicry of natural abundance. The new cemeteries looked as if they were extended grounds for such domiciles. The picturesque pocket companion and visitor's guide through Mount Auburn rightly points to the, quote, unusual variety of trees, the beautifully undulating surface, the flowers and ornamental shrubs, the carefully measured paths of Mount Auburn, as evidence of picturesque landscape gardening. The rural cemetery plot, like the proto-suburban home, gained significance solely through its owner's fond appreciation. The cemetery plots, like their descendants, the suburban homes, manifest just enough variety to pay tribute to the fact of distinct ownership and to perpetuate the romance of individual reduplication of an utterly standard theme. The dead and their places of rest have become very much the property of the living. That closes that subsection, and we'll close it there today. And so that's sort of a very good idea of what was going on in relation to social customs and death, embalming, the funeral itself, its place in the American imagination, and as the relation of basically gardening and landscaping and art in relation to it and how the people felt. Thanks for being with me today. I'll be back with you with more from The Feminization of American Culture by Ann Douglas real soon.